Welcome back to Everything is a Primary Source, the podcast version of going to a Tim Burton-themed restaurant in Manhattan and chatting with an actor portraying Jack Skellington about The Nightmare Before Christmas. All right, that is very specific to this episode, as you are about to listen to me and Nick Vincent Barbera, whom I met at Beetle House NYC a few years ago, as he was performing as the Pumpkin King, analyze the 1993 animated masterpiece. This is what the show is all about, dissecting media to determine how it acts as a reflection of the era and society from which it came. But before we walk into Halloween Town, here's some thoughts about two real Halloween towns. My family and I visited Sleepy Hollow, New York for the second time in 3 years this past weekend, and just as before, we enjoyed what the Westchester County Village displays this time of year, when Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow comes to life in several different ways throughout town. But we live in New Hampshire, so another major Halloween haunt, Salem, Massachusetts, is much closer, and a place we've visited several times and at different points of the year. I visited Salem for the first time one summer when I was about 8 years old, and my main memories from that trip include being freaked out by the mannequins, the Witch Museum, and having our family's ice cream order total come to $6.66 across the street after our tour. Subsequent visits have given me the opportunity to explore what Salem has to offer besides things tethered to witches and other October staples like vampires and ghosts. The city offers a variety of historic sites, especially connected to its rich nautical history, as well as literature, namely Nathaniel Hawthorne. What's interesting is that Salem's claim to being a Halloween capital comes from a real series of events in 1690s, the Salem Witch Trials, while Sleepy Hollow is a location written about in fiction. The Headless Horseman is a character in a story within a story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which was published in 1820. But visiting both of these places, you wouldn't necessarily recognize the differences, as they both present their spooky figures similarly. Salem's police force, which some guy impersonates in the 1993 Hocus Pocus, and fire department famously has a witch on a broomstick crossing a full moon as their seal. Sleepy Hollow's first responders, similarly, show their main attraction, the Headless Horseman, brandishing a jack-o'-lantern on their vehicles and uniforms. A long history of heraldry explains this for both towns, but the Sleepy Hollow one makes a little more sense since their character actually did come from there, both in folklore and in literature. Meanwhile, witches, especially the variety that wear all black and ride brooms around, are not real. It did not actually exist in 1690s New England or anywhere else for that matter. Much of why and how these two Halloween towns have developed the way they have can be figured out through treating the towns themselves as primary sources. The Salem we know today is a product of four different time periods. The late 17th century, when the Puritans from Salem Village, now Danvers, accused their fellow residents of working with the devil. The mid-19th century, when the bustling commercial-based Salem town became a city. The early 20th century, when its city leaders began referring to it as Witch City. And the 1950s, when playwright Arthur Miller wrote The Crucible, himself using primary source documents to make it as true to history as possible. It was in the last two time periods where we get the competing narratives of Salem and why tourists descend on the city, especially in October. It doesn't hurt that Salem is just north of, and actually part of, the major metropolitan area of Boston. Before the 1920s, Salem was recognized for pretty much everything else besides the witch trials. But with the rise of automobile driving, day trippers, locales across the country wanted to draw tourists to them, and so looking into features that differentiate one place from the other became the go-to to promote each destination. What's more distinct and unique to advertise than with witches, especially if the true story is watered down and fictionalized to get people there? Visiting nearby Danvers a few years ago, which is much less populated, more suburban place than Salem, and where the bulk of the Salem quote-unquote witches came from, I came across a historic marker from 1933. It refers to the Salem witch trials and those who started it as mischief makers. Just a few blocks away stands a memorial dedicated to the victims of the panic that was designed and dedicated in the 1990s. It is quite the moving tribute to the poor people who were killed over superstition and mass hysteria. This transition in perspective is owed entirely to Arthur Miller's play, itself an intentional document of Red Scare era fears and persecution. Without updating and humanizing the real events of 1690s Massachusetts, we wouldn't have the serious side of Salem's witch-related tourism. That's not to say that silliness has been erased altogether. As I mentioned, Hocus Pocus came out the same year as the memorial in Danvers, and by no means do the Sanderson sisters have any basis in reality. But theirs and countless other Halloween symbols are very much represented all over town. And their comedy saga repaints Salem's history and honestly its actual appearance. Both the original and last year's sequel try to pass off Salem as small town USA, with a little witch footnote in its history that only the super knowledgeable are aware of. The Hocus Pocus movies are almost alternate universe stories, relying on both the existence of actual witches and Arthur Miller not writing a play about the community. Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is a great early example of American pop culture. His first name gives away that the author himself is a product of the Revolutionary era, and the style and subjects of his writing are documents of early 19th century America, more specifically the Middle States region of the developing North. The story has been retold many times over, including a famous Disney cartoon, various picture books, an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark, and of course, the 1999 Tim Burton film. More recently, Sleepy Hollow is the name of a science fiction police drama, which, just like Hocus Pocus, reworks the real town's appearance and vibe to be far more urban rather than significantly suburban. Two of the most important time periods for Sleepy Hollow's identity are chronicled in the story about Ichabod Crane and his being chased out of town by the Headless Horseman, or Brom Bones, more accurately, in my opinion anyway. The early Dutch colonial period and the Revolutionary War make up those two time periods. Tarrytown, of which Sleepy Hollow is a village, does have at least one quote-unquote witch as part of their history, but her story is linked to the Revolutionary War along with the fictional Hessian horseman. Also, British Major John Andre and his apprehension and execution as a spy, the first part of that saga taking place in Sleepy Hollow, is a real person and true story that is used by Washington Irving to tell his other story. All of this is represented in most of the Halloween celebrations of the community, but spread out differently than what one will see in Salem. Aside from a few attractions, Sleepy Hollow seems to have devoted itself to present its Halloweenness from a historical perspective rather than a fictional one, which, as I began with, is interesting considering it's actually the other way around than from Salem's actual events that act as the foundation for what it conveys in a rather fictional way. For most of the community's existence, it has been part of Tarrytown, a community known by anyone who's ever crossed the Tappan Zee Bridge because it's the first exit after crossing on the eastbound side. But in 1996, Sleepy Hollow received its own designation, and since then the name has appeared on signs along the many parkways and highways leading to it. This has to be part of the same pop culture movement that transformed Salem into how it appears today. As Nick and I discuss in today's episode, home video, cable TV, movies, well, mass media in general, had become such a force in American society. And combined with more ways to get from one place to another, and with New York City being right down the road from Sleepy Hollow, basing tourism on recognizable media titles only makes sense for the modern era. As we get into the breakdown of 1993's The Nightmare Before Christmas, we should consider that it is just one of several indicators of how our society's relationship with and the basis for Halloween has altered over its history. These two towns, Salem and Sleepy Hollow, both help document the same development by way of what they've contributed to the overall climate of spooky fall fun. Thank you, Eric, for those insightful comments. Always a pleasure. I'd like to take this opportunity to plug my website, everythinghistory.com. That's the source of info about this podcast, as well as my consulting and coaching offerings. I'll be presenting the Everything as a Primary Source method and mindset a week from today in Concord, New Hampshire, followed by a day of podcast karaoke at the NHCSS conference. That's New Hampshire Council for the Social Studies. Then later this fall, I'll be doing the same thing over 2 days in Nashville during the National Council for the Social Studies annual conference. You can get in on the action by attending either of these conferences or by simply going to everythinghistory.com. That's everything-history.com. And now, on to the big show. Today marks 30 years since Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas was released in theaters. What a perfect day for it, October 13th. But maybe a better day would be Thanksgiving Day. After all, as a film that begins on November 1st and culminates with Christmas Day, Thanksgiving is the perfect balance. Anyhow, here's Nick Barber and I and our breakdown.
The list of people who have appeared most often. This is Nick Barbera, and welcome back to the show. It seems like every season I have you to talk about something chilling, spooky, creepy. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. Yeah, this has been, I don't know how many times at this point, but I've been on here for quite a few.
Yeah, well, it's funny because the first time I ever met you, it was as your alter ego, Jack Skellington. And so it kind of like springboarded from there, this, friendship. And I think we met maybe twice in Beetle House, and the second time was like a week before COVID. It was like early March 2020. And I have pictures still of like my whole family and you, and I think the owner or something hanging outside, you know, taking our pictures and stuff. And it's like, it was like the last known picture before the world turned upside down. It was such a surreal thing after that. And ever since then, our world has just been like online, you know, just talking and through cameras and stuff like that. So you were saying because of what you do at Beetle House and just off before I hit record, things are getting pretty busy in October. You guys having to take reservations weeks in advance, probably, right?
Absolutely. We've been looking at the reservations through the rest of the month ahead already, and it's a roller coaster of the different crowds of people to a point where we take a look at the total number of covers and, you know, it's like, can we even fit this many? But they find a way.
Yeah.
Which is the great news, obviously, but.
Well, and it's even better news because it's the one place really in the country and maybe in the world that it's Halloween all year round. So it's not like everywhere else where once it hits November 1st, it's really weird doing Halloween type stuff. Whereas there it's like, it's perfectly acceptable. So if you can't get in this month, it's not the end of the world. If you, you know, show up in November 5th or something like that. And it's always a great time there. So today's topic is The Nightmare Before Christmas, which the movie came out 30 years ago. Well, I'm going to be releasing this on the 13th, which we have a Friday the 13th in October this year. So that's exciting. And the movie came out on October 13th, but in 1993, that was a Wednesday, which I think is kind of unique because I guess I didn't recall that movies were released that early back in the 90s. I thought that was a trend of like the 2000s and 2010s when, you know, a big action movie came out or any kind of movie after a while and they're like midnight showing on Wednesday, you know, to start the weekend off. But I guess they did that back in the back in 93. But before we launch into it, obviously you have a deep relationship with this movie because you've had to study it When you got the job at Beetle House, did you ask to be Jack Skellington?
Not really. I really landed the job through a couple of my friends who I was working with at Sleepy Hollow at the time for their haunted house. They went over for their interview with Beetle House, and they knew that I was a huge fan of Nightmare Before Christmas ever since I was a kid, and that growing up, being an actor in like plays and stuff, I wanted to play Jack Skellington in something. I didn't really care what or where. I just wanted to do it. And, you know, so I've worked on the voice and the mannerisms on my own time, like just for fun. So basically during their interview, my name came up in conversation and they said, oh, okay, we haven't really had like they've had Jack Skellington before, technically, like someone else was in makeup and slicked her hair back and it looked really cool, but that didn't really last too long. So they said, oh, can he come in for an interview? They said, we'll ask him. So they told me about it and I was like, absolutely. So I coordinated. The next day I had my own interview and I traveled all the way over there specifically for this opportunity. And then I had the interview and I felt as if I was horribly underprepared, if at all, because all I had working off of me was a photo of myself in high school with face makeup as Jack. And, you know, I didn't really have anything entirely too professional, like what I assumed they were looking for. So I had the interview and, you know, it went well. But then after the end of it, it kind of felt like one of those don't call us, we'll call you kind of scenarios where I thought to myself, well, I guess I didn't get it, but at least they know I exist. But then later on August 25th of that year, I believe it was 2018, they contacted me and said, hey, we're going to be having a big celebration because it's Tim Burton's birthday. And, you know, we want to celebrate it in a big way. Are you available? I said, is that even a question? I would be so down. So from that day on, I just kind of kept on working away at Beetle House. So it wasn't really anything that was like, you know, necessarily, oh, we have a Jack Skellington already, but you'd be a good backup. It was more like they didn't really have one. And so they were, you know, that was on the list of characters that they were looking for. And I just so happened to fill the spot.
Kind of fit it perfectly. And I love about Jack Skellington is that, and honestly, all the characters in the movie, is that when you first meet them, you feel like they have a significant backstory, that there is quite a bit more to the character than what we're first encountering. And of course, there's always, like, you know, on YouTube and stuff, they point out in Beetlejuice, you get to see Jack Skellington's face on top of his head when he's rising out of the model of the town.
And, that's right.
Yeah, that's the first spotting of him. Like, it's just a skull face. It's really not necessarily him. It's just kind of
right,
like,
yeah,
a very Burton-esque skeleton. Uh-huh. But when you meet him in the movie, you know, with the outstanding opening music and everything, this is Halloween, and then you see him, it's like there's definitely more, there was a lot of like preparation for this character and everybody else in Halloween Town, and we're just kind of like getting our meeting to him. Like, so when you prepared as Jack, did you kind of feel that way too? There, like you were saying, like, you're like, I'm not really quite, like, am I doing this right? Because, like, I feel like this character needs to a lot of, you know, he deserves justice. You know, he needs to, you know, live up to the Jack Skellington name.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a kind of conversation that we have at work sometimes still, where, I mean, it doesn't matter which character we are, but what does matter is that we meet up to some of the guests' expectations, if not all of them. By that, I mean, you know, in the case of Jack, you know, my rules are very strict about how I portray him there, because people go in there expecting to meet him the way that they know him and the way that they remember him best. And just to carry a conversation with him in a way that only he could. So what I mean by that is, you know, really taking my own time to explore on my own his likes, his dislikes, what I think he would enjoy, what I think he wouldn't enjoy. You know, people are still going to ask him about the Christmas thing, so I have to follow up with that. You know, how does time go by after he tried out Christmas back then, you know, and does that still affect him now as it did then, you know, like that kind of deal. But so there's a little bit more of an actor's character's evolution there, if that makes sense. But, you know, in terms of the way that people remember Jack Best, you know, I still throw in a lot of references from the movie in there, obviously. And, you know, but still leaving some room for new things to explore. In a way, it really is kind of like what Jack would want, you know, that longing for something new in there, while also keeping true with the tradition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I was actually, my son and I were putting up our Jack Skellington in our yard today, you know, decorating for Halloween. And we have like this big pole. I tried to use it as a tetherball pole, but that didn't work out. It's actually meant to be like a temporary pillar for like a garage that's falling down or something. And I just, you know, had it because the shed it was holding up did fall down. So I just tried to use it for tetherball, and now it's just in the yard. And I'm like, all right, something's going on here. So I put Jack up there, and you know, we're going to have all sorts of different kinds of pumpkins underneath him because he's the pumpkin king. So he's going to be, you know, lording over his realm. And my son said, he's like, Jack is, you know, he's kind of scary. He's kind of mean. I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't think he's actually mean at all. He gets mad at Oogie Boogie, you know. Absolutely. That's for sure. He doesn't like him because he goes too far. Mm-hmm. And I said, I always like characters like Jack Skellington where it's like he has a menacing look to him. I mean, the man has a skull face, and you know, he kind of has that spooky, very gothic, you know, way about him. But he's not at all evil. He's not bad. He is actually a really good guy. But I love characters that can, because when he gets mad, oh man, it's just like
very steamed. Yeah.
And I'm like, I like that. I like that kind of character where it's like he's on our side, but you know, he still looks pretty bad. You know, he looks tough. And I like guys like that. So you know, my son just kind of shrugged and was like, okay. You know, as I lectured him about Jack Skellington, as I, you know, put it up there. But the way that I do things, and you know this being a guest before, is we treat, in this case, a movie as if it was being entered into a museum as an artifact. So if you've ever been to any museum, particularly history museums, they usually have something on display, an artifact, and then a little card which explains, you know, what conclusions can be drawn from that piece of pottery or, you know, the dress or some kind of, you know, relic that's left there. And that usually comes from somebody dissecting it like we're about to do for this movie. So we have a number of questions to answer. You know, there's really no question we have to start with, but I usually do start at the top with the material that it's made from. And this is what gets a lot of confusion for people, I think, including myself for the very longest time. It's called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. So it's an assumption that Tim Burton had a very heavy hand involved in the making of this movie. But as it turns out, it's more or less he's came up with the main characters and the story, but then just kind of walked away from there. Is that the way you understand it as well?
Absolutely. I think that I personally think that Henry Selick should get more credit where it's due because he was the guy who really directed the film. And I believe at the same time, Tim Burton was really working on Batman Returns, so he couldn't really be there as often as people believe he was. So, and I think that the fact that it's called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, I think that was more like a last minute marketing strategy. I don't recall if that's entirely correct, so don't quote me on that, even though it's on a podcast, but I'm not sure.
I feel like I've gone over enough of those different articles and YouTube videos that people make that does sound about right, that it's something he wanted to do, but as you said, he was very busy with Batman Returns. This is almost like, so his career really kicked off with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but before that it was Frankenweenie, the short. Mm-hmm. So he's like riding the crest of this wave through the late 80s. And then right after Batman in 89 and Beetlejuice before that, it's, it's like he probably had no idea just how huge and in demand his storytelling was going to be. And so he has this idea for a really, and it's a fantastic idea, the idea of like holiday towns kind of all bunched together in this dimension somewhere and interacting with each other. I mean, that's such a cool idea. But then just at the last minute, he's like, I can't do it all, so I'm just kind of, I'm going to put my best people on this. I'm going to, everything's going to kind of reflect me. And I think that really says right there by the early 1990s, just how involved into our lexicon Tim Burton had become. And that's actually a really short amount of time, 9 years, not even a full decade. He's already gone from nobody, some guy working at Disney to then making this huge series of really big movies. What does that say to you about American culture and society in the early 90s? That, this guy who'd been making kind of weird movies for a while is now so mainstream that they can slap his name at the beginning of a movie and everybody that as a marketing scheme, as a way to get people in the seats.
I feel as if like with Tim Burton's style, especially, you have this guy who had a very distinct style and a sense of vision that was so weird and so strange that not too many people were doing, even though it was very rooted in early Hollywood, like German Expressionism and things like that. But here's a guy who is, in a way, kind of fully reviving it in a way that still captures people's attention. But like, people, I guess, just didn't really know what to do with him other than just go see these movies and just see how weird they were. Like, if you go back and you listen to critical receptions of most of his films, particularly Beetlejuice, people went to go see it, but they thought it was so weird and it didn't make any sense. But it still captured their attention, so they still went over to go see it. I think the same thing with Edward Scissorhands and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, those films. And even Batman, the films that did well, but everybody critically was just like, what do we make of this guy?
Right.
But somehow I want to keep seeing more. So I have a feeling that by taking his name and putting it in front of The Nightmare Before Christmas, it's right in there with his lexicon. So when people see his name, they're like, oh my God, we got to go see this new Tim Burton movie. Same thing kind of happens right now, with, the films that he makes now. When you see the name Tim Burton, you think all of that crazy, wacky themes of the dead and things like that. And you're like, oh, I'm very fascinated. I want to go see it.
And black and white stripes will be involved somehow.
Big time. They at least make one appearance in something somewhere.
As even Sweeney Todd, I was like, oh my God, they're in Sweeney Todd. It's almost, I think maybe in a way they felt they had to put his name attached to it, even though he wasn't super involved, because if people watched that in the theater, they'd be like, wait a minute, this is a Tim Burton ripoff. He'd become so well known by that point that they'd be like, what's the deal? They're totally taking his style. And then, so maybe as just a safeguard against that, they said, all right, we're just going to put Tim Burton's. So just to clear it off with everybody, this is him. kind of sanctioning this movie. And yeah, I was watching, we watched Frankenweenie last night, the original one, not the 2012 one.
Right.
Yeah. And just, that's almost like a 30 minute preview of the next, you know, decade of his movies, where just imagery wise, the way it's like, you know, the part towards the end is very like Edward Scissorhands when, you know, everybody's chasing him out of town, and you know, it's like, and then he saves a kid, and it's like everything is all kind of, and I think you're right. There's a fascination with Tim Burton that people had throughout the 80s and 90s of like, he's giving us pretty standard movies. Each one has at least a few weird parts in it, but overall, like if we were to net it all together, we're like, yeah, I guess overall he's making pretty standard fare. It's just with a twist. Right. It's not so weirdo. It's not necessarily like David Lynch type stuff, you know, where you have to sit there and crack a code while you're watching, be like, oh yeah, I know what that means. It's like, it's pretty straightforward stuff. It just has very, you know, I'll keep using the term Burton-esque features throughout it. Now, one of the other questions that comes up in this same segment is, how was it made? One thing that I oftentimes forget while watching this is stop animation. That's why it took so long to make, but it's so well done that you kind of forget that it was using a very traditional style of, and he used lots of stop animation in a lot of his pictures. What do you think? I mean, we're 93, so that's like right at the precipice of when computers started really taking over everything. That's when Jurassic Park came out and, you know, showed that computer animation could be successful to make realistic stuff. But even they were still using practical stuff, you know, to make Jurassic Park. Do you think, had the computers been at that point, would they still have gone with stop animation to get that look?
I do firmly think so, because the story of Nightmare Before Christmas, to begin with, back when Tim Burton was working as an animator at Disney, was more or less a good parody of those classic Christmas stories.
Yeah.
Before, like Rudolph, how the Grinch stole Christmas, and Rudolph, where it was like Burton's version of it, despite how really, when you get down to it, how twisted it was. So I think they had the idea at the very beginning to have it be stop motion. So that way it's not just that, but also a parody of the old stop motion Christmas specials like Rudolph and Santa Claus is coming to town and that kind of deal. But there's something about this stop motion that I think is so mesmerizing and is right in between computers and live action, where it's so mesmerizing to watch because of how fluid it ends up being anyway. And it still retains that sort of look and feel that a story like Nightmare Before Christmas could fit into. And sometimes I do wonder what it would look like if it was computer generated, like Toy Story or something. And interesting as it would have been, and as groundbreaking as it probably would have been technology-wise, I really don't think it would have struck a chord with people, the like how Toy Story did uniquely in terms of animation, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like, it still would have looked cool and interesting, but there's something about stop motion as a medium that, first of all, is, I think, is very underrated no matter what time of the decade it was. And you know, it still kind of is, which is the sad truth of it. But I think it's something about Nightmare Before Christmas carrying on that specific art medium. And again, I really think that it's a good story that only stop motion can tell.
Yeah, and it gives that nice 90s energy to it, too. It's not...
Yes, big some of those, time,
I mean, because they could have done... You know, you're mentioning these, you know, the 60s stop animation ones, you know, stop motion ones like Rudolph and stuff. And I'm sure they had a much lower budget than what he was working with.
Much lower.
You know, it's just like one camera angle per scene. You know, they just kind of move around the screen a little bit, you know, Gumby type stuff. And the reason why you forget that it's stop motion in the 93 movie is because there's so many different angles. They zoom in, they do, you know, wide shots, they do close-ups. I mean, it's really all over the place, like a regular movie by that point. That's how they were making all those movies. So you have the stop motion, you can check that box, be like, yeah, we're doing, you know, homage or my version of those other ones, but it's also the 90s and this is how we make movies now. You know, right. It's like that dark, you know, everything is dark. And that's, I think, what he had been known for by that point, of everything is just dark, dark, dark. You know, it's like the Batman movies, both of them, you know, especially Returns, is just like, I don't think you see daylight in that entire film. You know, the second one, it's just like,
I don't even think once. All, you're right.
Yeah, it's like nighttime all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's became his MO for sure. And so even though he wasn't involved in this so much, it was that how it was made was under his kind of like spirit, like his the way he would make it for sure. I would think that, yeah, and Toy Story has to be, you know, has to be digital. It doesn't work if it's anything else, because that was part of the movie, is like, look what we can do with computers now. And, you know, it's like if they had tried to do it, you'd see the guy's hand in the back holding Woody, and, you know, that'd be lame.
Right. Yeah.
So we were talking, you know, the next question that comes up is who likely made it, or who made it? And, you know, we started off by talking about Tim Burton. Tell me a little bit about the director of The Nightmare Before Christmas. What is his sort of, what was his status as a director or in filmmaking before this movie?
Well, Henry Selick, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know too much about his career before Nightmare Before Christmas. I do know that he was also the guy who made Monkey Bone with Brendan Fraser, and there was already some stop motion in there. And other people know him post Nightmare Before Christmas for making movies like Coraline and even more recently Wendell and Wild, both really fun stop motion films involving creepy themes. So I don't know terribly much about him before Nightmare Before Christmas, other than I suppose that they found him as the perfect director to help with Nightmare Before Christmas because of his work on Monkey Bone, because it proved that he can do stop motion, like, you know, very similar to the other masters of stop motion, like Ray Harryhausen and guys like that. So I think that by him having a director that way, I want to say that maybe Tim Burton felt a little more comfortable putting it on his hands, so he could be like, all right, this guy knows what he's doing, so I'm going to leave him in charge of directing the picture while I go off and make Batman Returns, because this guy knows what he knows his stuff.
Just doing a quick look at his stuff, it doesn't look like he had done much before it, but afterwards, that's when the floodgates open, because James and the Giant Peach is under his direction, which is
James and the Giant Peach. Yeah, I forgot something. I did,
and it's it's like shame. So it's almost like he was the next version of Tim Burton, where he had been working. He did like smaller stuff, kind of, you know, and then this was his big break. This is what made his name known and created a status for him. We can't also forget about Danny Elfman though, because this is a musical.
That's right.
And so he's heavily involved in what's different. I mean, people make fun of it. So I remember seeing Family Guy one time, when I don't really watch Family Guy ever, but I just happened to see one of their parodies of Star Wars. And they're like, okay, Danny Elfman's now going to be doing the music. And they have the background that, you know, it's like, you know, teasing it that way. I'm like, yeah, he does kind of add that backbeat, you know, pretty much identical throughout all of his movies. And sometimes they kind of blend into one, but he goes so well with Tim Burton. Like, the two of them, if you listen to Oingo Boingo, you're like, this is not normal music. It's not totally insane music. It's just not mainstream music. And Tim Burton's not a mainstream filmmaker. Of course, they're going to go together really well. And my understanding is that the two of them kind of had a falling out for a short time because of Nightmare, that they were just working so hard on it, particularly Danny, and they just kind of you know, the way I read it is that just two creative minds like theirs can only go so long without clashing that they just, right. just stopped talking for like a year and a half. And that's why Ed Wood was not with Danny Elfman doing the soundtrack for that.
Right.
But all the other movies are. And so they go so well together. And Nightmare stands out because he sang in it, where, you know, the voice mm-hmm. for Jack Skellington, Chris Randon from The Princess Bride.
That's right. I
love that movie so much. I love his character so much. Totally underrated character in The Princess Bride.
Absolutely.
And his voice is so perfect for Jack. It's just, you know, similar characters. And mm-hmm. and then, but Danny Elfman does the singing in it, and which is not normal for him to do that for a movie. So it's almost like this is like the magnum opus for him. It was like he was not just doing the score, he was actually contributing as a singer to it as well. Mm-hmm. So do you think that the musical component to it, does that fall in line with the drive to make it like those 1960s stop animation Christmas specials?
I don't know if I would say the 1960 Christmas specials, but I wouldn't put it past them if that was also the intention, particularly with What's This? Because, you know, since we're talking about those specials, you know, you're in an environment that is celebrating Christmas all the time. You have to have a song that's very whimsical and falls in line with that. Mm. But I feel as if with the musical drive for this film in particular, again, I have a feeling that it's very much like we're telling this story in our unique way, while still, I guess, keeping in line with some of the musical traditions that Disney was doing at this time, like with the musical songs that they were really driving back into around the time that this movie was being made. So I don't really know about the 60s Christmas special songs per se. I think that really it does fall more in line with, you know, the return to the musical format that Disney was trying to get back to. But that's my outlook.
Anyway. Yeah. I always just think about the ones with Bing Crosby, you know, he's like narrating it and
yes.
you know, singing, or Burl Ives shows up as Frosty the Snowman, and you know mm-hmm. they have like their little song and dance numbers, and there's so many of those movies or TV, you know, special things from that era. I lose track of mm-hmm. them sometimes. Like I used to try to watch them in reruns, and I'm like, I don't even know what this one is now. Like there's a monster, there's like you know Martians or something. You know, there's all this crazy right. stuff happening. I'm like, what, you know. Why not just the, you know, straightforward story? And mm-hmm. so they might have been riffing on that a little bit too. Be like, okay, we're going to actually do a good one now. And one that's pretty, you know, remarkably memorable. Right. You know, and so, you know, the next question that comes up is why did they make it? And mm-hmm. I dwell on this maybe a little bit more too much than I should, but you know, I was 12 years old when this movie came out. So I was like right in that zone of, you know, I was just about to be a teenager. I was, you know, feeling like a lot of the movies and stuff were geared right towards me, or maybe just a little bit older than me. The 90s, as we already stated, have like an edge to them. They have this kind of darkness to it. And I feel like this movie kind of hits that right in the middle, because it's not... And we may as well talk about the intended audience right now, too, because it's not really quite, you know, it's not a terrifying movie. It has its, you know, kind of unsettling images throughout it, but it's not by any means like a horror film. But it's also not mm-hmm. a little kid, you know, G-rated thing. I feel like, you know, this is just my opinion. I'll let you talk and add yours in just a moment. But I feel like they made it because they're like, well, it is the 90s, so we really should be making something like this. You know, now is the time. Now is when Disney can actually put this out, and it's not just some, you know, if it was 10 years earlier, it probably would have been some, smaller studio or something that would throw it together, like the people that made California Raisins. But what do you think? Why do you think that they made it when they did?
I think it also has to do with the fact that, because we were talking about it earlier, how Tim Burton had a sudden rise in stardom with his films. Because after his falling out with Disney, that's when he went on to do Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands. Those were like the main core of his filmography, and he was really cementing his artistic style in films, and everybody was eating it up. And luckily for Disney, they already had a couple of his projects on the wayside, you know, that he really wanted to do. And they still had, you know, the like Frankenweenie and that odd Hansel and Gretel short he did, as well as, yeah, that kind of stuff just under their belt anyway. So they were just like, hey, Tim, we still have this poem that you did. If you want to do it with us, you're more than welcome to. To which, you know, I guess they finally reached an agreement. And he was like, yes, I want to make. Because I also understand, before he left Disney, he also wanted to adapt his own poem in some way, I think as a TV special at a time. So it really would have been a parody of the old Christmas specials. But then at this point, Disney saw what he could do with full-length feature films. And so, you know, he was given a lot more room to play in terms of story and different visual styles and things like that.
Do you think this may have been like an olive branch of sorts from Disney to say, all right, you know, we maybe want to work with you now instead of, you know, we've arrived now at the same point you were. We weren't there back when you worked for us in the early 80s, but, you know, we're there now. And here's our evidence of that, is that we want to make this, we want to flesh this out into a whole movie.
I think so. I have a feeling that that was what their intention was, because I mean I'm sure we'll get to it eventually, you know, like what happened with the cultural impact post the movie release, but there is a lot of stuff that Tim Burton and Disney have done collaboratively to further establish his artistic style, but also really establish the impact that this movie in particular left on people. You know, so I think most likely in the long run, that's what Disney wanted. And in a way, that's kind of what they ended up getting.
The next question might be really inconsequential in a long way. It's where was it made and or what locations were are associated with it. And so, I mean, I guess we could say anywhere. I'm sure it was made in a particular sound studio, probably in LA or maybe even England. I think I remember hearing somewhere that they did some of it in London or something. But that, I mean, it's not going to tell us much about that, but the locations associated with it. I love the idea of each holiday having its own town. And favorite things, and this might cross over into the ideas and behaviors does it convey, but one of my favorite things is from the very beginning of the movie when he comes back from Halloween on Earth and they already are like, let's start getting ready for next year. Like for some reason that idea of somebody being so single-minded, it's like, you know, and the following year they do the exact same thing with the Santa Claus when, you know, Scott Calvin arrives in the North Pole and there's Bernard ordering the elves around. And he's like, are you on a break? And it's like, it's Christmas Day. It's like, it's actually Christmas Day. And he's like, we got to get ready for next year. And it's like, I love, you know, and in real life, that does kind of happen. Like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which is coming up, they start getting ready for the next one like the next day. As soon as the, I mean, not everybody, obviously, but the planners for it, they really do have to spend most of the year thinking about it. Does every holiday actually have its own town? Does Arbor Day have a town?
I have wondered about that. If that holiday has its own, I like to think that probably Arbor Day has its own like little village, not so much a town.
Yeah,
but more like a park. An Amish cozy kind of deal. Yeah, like a park.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of deal.
Because they actually do have a Charlie Brown movie called that, which I rented one time from, or didn't rent it, I borrowed it from the library. It's right. Arbor Day, Charlie Brown. I'm like, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. honestly, not the most exciting of. They planted a tree on his pitcher's mound. I remember that part.
Right. They say they got to give that day some love at least, you know.
Yeah. It's an important one. I have to say that I love it. Maybe they all get it, but I think that's such a clever storytelling thing where it's just like, okay, you know, we, and not to keep bringing up the Santa Claus movies, but they dabble in that a little bit too in the second Santa Claus movies, or maybe the third, right, where all the different, like the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny and all the different, you know, mascots for the holidays and mm-hmm. you know, characters along with Santa Claus all meet together and have a conference, you know, from time to time. I just think it's mm-hmm. so clever.
I remember watching the second Santa Claus when that scene happened, and as a little kid, I felt kind of ripped off because you have all these characters and I don't see Jack Skellington anywhere. I still think sometimes, how cool would it have been, like, if they negotiated with Tim Burton to just say, hey, can we use this character in this scene for the holidays? And if he said yes, how they would have done it, especially in live action. He probably would have looked horrifying.
Right. Well, I've seen like the Broadway when they've done the live version and stuff, like the musical acts, it does look kind of mm-hmm. terrifying. It's like, you know, they have a bald cap or a bald guy and he's like he looks really scary. But you know, maybe they mm-hmm. at the very least, because it's also a Disney movie, they probably could have just said, oh, Jack can't be here right now, or you know, that would have been fine, you know,
probably kind of
referenced, yep, you know, that he's busy at the moment. You know,
or like
some kind of like uprising
probably, like, I'm still suffering the nightmares from that. I don't want him here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, because Santa is the one that gets, you know, kidnapped by him. But all that's like so
right,
it's so like kind of innocent and childlike for Jack. He's like, well, I'm just gonna kidnap the guy and I'll take over. I'm really, you know, fascinated by what he does every year, so, you know, instead of scaring kids, I'll go give them presents. I love this idea, it's so great. And mm-hmm. you know what he's doing ultimately is, you know, completely crazy and terrible for Santa, but in his mind he's like, hey, everyone gets, you know, you might want to try my job someday, Santa. Movie made for, do you think? Who's the intended audience?
I know that we briefly touched upon the, you know, how the movie was rated and also like the time that it came out, like during the 90s and things like that. And I guess very much like the first initial reception from audiences about it, it kind of is a, I think it's a nice middle ground between kids and adults, where you get to have this story that has some, I guess, pretty like spooky imagery that you can enjoy with Halloween, but also like this really nice, pure feel of Christmas that it also goes hand in hand with. So I think in terms of what the key audience is, I want to say, honestly, outside of the main Disney demographic, which was families, that's exactly that, like families, which could mean it's for anyone that has their attention grabbed by the story and the visual style. I want to say also, you know, it's right up there with the people who had enjoyed Tim Burton's filmography again to begin with, because you have all of this imagery of really scary stuff, but also like it knows how to let loose and have some fun with it. And I think that once you have that kind of a style patented down, then you have a demographic that's really broad. So I would say, in a short answer, I would say, families who are looking for, again, that happy balance between scary and fun. Kind of like how the movie
Yeah.
is with finding that balance of Halloween and Christmas.
Right. It's like my first Tim Burton movie. It's like a kid's, and it's an introduction to, because a young kid in 1983 might have been too young for Batman and some of the stuff in there, too intense for them, but they can handle, this one. And so it's an introduction to his style of filmmaking without being too over the top or scary. And without him really being all that involved in it, I also think it has something to do with, this is the age of the home video, so it's not just, it came out perfect time of year. Hocus Pocus came out the same year, but in like the spring for some reason. I don't know who was thinking about that. Another dis does another Disney movie, and I love it. I think it's, I didn't know, I don't even remember it coming out at all back then. Like, I think I remember seeing a preview for Hocus Pocus when I was a kid, but because it came out in the spring, I was like not thinking Halloween movies. And I didn't actually see it for the first time until probably about, 15 years ago now. And I loved it. I still love it. I think it's a great movie. But it's also VHS. That's how it became a cult hit, was because of VHS. And I think they probably recognized that like, we're going to put it out now in October. This thing can actually be watched pretty much all the way through to Christmas in the theater or at home, next year. And so it's a great, there's your audience right there too, is the rental families or the people who want to give it as a gift for Christmas next year and have it on family viewing night or rent it, later on down the road. It's like, oh yeah, this is a great, somebody put it once. They're like, well, it's a Thanksgiving movie because it's right in between Halloween and Christmas. So there you go. There's your Thanksgiving movies. They don't make Thanksgiving movies, but this one kind of is. And so I think that that's also, because if they, and I hate doing this thing of like always saying like, well, if it was now, things have changed so much. But just in perspective, they would probably release this on streaming in the modern age. Like, I don't know if it would get a theater release necessarily. For that reason, like perfect timing for Halloween, and then you can, its themes will lead you right into the holiday season. So they recognized that people were still keeping those patterns in their yearly schedule, and they were making room in their holiday celebrations for movie watching. That became part of the ritual of family time in the 90s, was renting movies, ordering pizza. Getting cozy in front of your screen and, hoping that the person that rented it before you, rewound it. So you don't turn it on and get the credits as soon as you, you're like, ah, now I know who produced it. So I know we've, I saved this last question for last, because I think we already touch on quite a bit of it already, but the ideas and behavior that it conveys. So, we haven't really talked about any of the other characters besides Jack and Santa Claus. What do you think? Let's think about some of the other characters too, and what they sort of represent, or what kind of conflicts come from them, and what other stories might be told throughout, maybe what kind of lessons or values are expressed through this. Besides Jack, who do you consider to like your favorite characters in the movie?
Without question, my favorite character in this movie is Sally. With
She's
Jack
great.
being a Jack being a close second, actually. The reason being is because, this is pretty much, she is the voice of reason in the film and the story. Like, she's really one of the only couple of characters that sees Jack's vision of Christmas for the land of the living as this idea that could really go sour. You know, the other one being Santa Claus, obviously. But
Right.
you know, with Sally, you have that, but you also have the element of this longing that she has for him romantically. Somebody who overhears him saying that, you know, this Halloween thing is getting so boring and I feel so empty because of it. And she understands that completely because she lives a very sheltered life. Her father keeps her in the tower of like a good 90% of the time. And she feels as if she's got eyes from her dad watching her all over the place. So you know, they both kind of have this sense of loneliness in a way where nobody's really listening to them. So because of that, there is a connection there, but it isn't met by Jack and it's longed for by Sally. So when Sally does finally get to interact with Jack, it almost like paints a different picture because she's trying to explain to this guy that she's longed for that, you know, l please, like, listen to me. What if this doesn't work? And Jack is really the one that's like, yeah, but what if it did? You know, so he's really been dancing around it just because he thinks that this thing is cool and he thinks it's great, you know, and he wants everybody to be involved. So his heart, if he had one, I guess, is in the right place, really. He just wants to do Christmas because he thinks it's different and it's pure. So when he hears a different opinion, he, you know, I hate to say it, but he doesn't want to hear it. He just wants to do it anyway. And it breaks Sally's heart because, you know, again, she's back in that place where she's trying to communicate her thoughts and feelings, but it isn't being heard by anybody, not even for the person that she longs for. But when it comes to close to the climax where it's, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but when it comes close to
Oh, no.
the climax where her vision of this going wrong is starting to come true, she doesn't just sit around. She like takes action about it. She's like, okay, where is this Sandy Claus? Where did they take him? I'm going to go find him myself, and I'm going to help fix this mess that's going on. Which, I mean, she does still end up getting captured by Oogie Boogie. But, you know, to see that even when Jack notices that she tried to help him and to save Christmas as well, like, that is the very thing that sparks the actual connection between the two of them now, because Jack realizes, oh, she really did mean what she said. Like, she was really trying to help me out of this mess. I
She
don't really
is.
think anybody else would have done that for me, you know, despite their
No.
support, you know, because they're fans, you know, she is an actual friend now. And so because of that makes her my favorite character in this story, because really she is the one that had started the attempt to save Christmas to begin with. So
Right.
and she had the drive for it. After all this time of being ignored, she's finally like, all right, enough's enough. I am going to fix this problem. And so, you know, even to the point where even the other characters recognize that. Like Santa calls her the only person that seems to make any sense, and Jack realizing that he's totally right.
Yeah. Her vo actual voice is Catherine O'Hara, which a more talented actor and singer you can't find. I mean, she is so funny and so talented with music. And I, you know, you look at the cast of this entire movie, and it's a who's who of Tim Burton's, you know, all of his films up until that point. And it's like there's a reason for that, right? It's like they all have the right mindset for these kinds of pictures. They understand gothic storytelling. They understand how to hit the right moments with comedy and their voice. And I realize it's just their voices. They're not actually acting it out themselves. But when I've seen them perform at, you know, anniversaries and stuff like that for The Nightmare Before Christmas, like they still embody the characters as themselves.
While we're talking about vocal performances, I mean, we can't leave out Ken Page, who was incredible as Oogie Boogie. I mean, we're talking about a guy who already had a wonderful stage presence with a lot of musicals and Broadway shows and things like that. So you get someone like him to play this very over-the-top, evil kind of guy, so evil that Halloween Town actually had to banish him. He's that evil. And, you know, but still a very theatrical villain, despite how small a screen time he's got. I mean, he also really, really did a fantastic job in that movie.
And he is actually scary, you know, that, you know, when you introduce, you know, when he's first introduced, and he's probably the closest that movie gets to actually being, you know, kids cover their eyes kind of thing. And you know, what's he going to do to Santa Claus? Like, what's he, you know, but that's what I would say seamless, but you know, the seam in his body kind of, that's his undoing, huh? But yeah, I think that whole dynamic takes it up a level, right? Where it makes it and it adds much more of a conflict to everything else. And the whole story is just so well done. I've been referring to Tim Burton all week on Instagram as a master storyteller. And this is just another one where it's like, you know, he's able to take, you know, if this was in anybody else's hands, it probably would not have come out the same way. And definitely not have this, we wouldn't be making a big deal of it being 30 years old. You know, we wouldn't be saying anniversary. We'd just be like, yeah, that movie. Oh, it's 30 years old. Okay. You know, big deal, you know, but it's like, let's take the last moment or so of this podcast. And you've been touching on it a little bit already. The cultural impact of this movie is pretty remarkable.
Big time. I mean, if we're really the condensed version of that is the one word, merchandising. Mm-hmm. It is so difficult to go out there and not see somebody wearing something with Jack Skellington's face, like a hat, a shirt, even pants or like socks or a pin. And that's just that's just scratching the surface. I mean, there's figures, there are like curtains, there is furniture, there is recreation of props from the movie in life size, there is like even soap for the bathroom, like all these different kinds of merchandise that people will just take no matter what it is, because it's Nightmare Before Christmas. And not only that, but one of my favorite things about the post Nightmare success is in Disneyland, every September through January, they take their Haunted Mansion attraction and they overlay it as a Haunted Mansion holiday. So Jack Skellington and his friends come from Halloween Town and put their idea of Christmas into the Haunted Mansion, because this is the perfect Christmas for those 999 happy haunts. And it's a great way to blend both the Haunted Mansion and Nightmare Before Christmas, these two properties by Disney that are so classic on their own, and having them blend in a way that is very seamless and very fun. And you know, just to see that kind of a Tim Burton artistic style in three dimensions and to be brought into it in some way, I think that is incredible. They do an incredible job every year.
It is. I was just in Disneyland this past summer, and I've been to Disney World several times. And this was my first time to Disneyland, and I'm always just I just marvel at everything that they do. Like even when a ride is closed, they make it special. You know, it's like, we're sorry. You know, it's like somehow it's like, you're like, oh wow. Like you just made my day by telling me that I can't get on this ride. You know, it's like, they have this just like certain quality about that, you know, everything that Disney touches. And the merchandising is probably mostly them. Like when I was putting up the Jack Skellington, you know, figurine today, I saw on the back of his skull, you know, Disney, you know, marking on there. And I'm like, yeah, if it wasn't for this powerhouse of Disney, they probably wouldn't have so much merchandise out there. But when people buy it and then they use it, it's definitely, it functions the same way as all merchandise like that does, where they're just displaying right. to each other and they're trying to tell people, this is like, I like this kind of movie. It's not horror. It's basically just kind of attaching themselves mm-hmm. to the creativity of it all. That the immense amount of talent and hard work and cleverness that had to go into making this movie 30 years ago, actually 32 years ago, because it took them 2 years to make it, you know, to come to fruition is so much different. I don't want to say it's more necessary than a drawn cartoon or other movies, you know, live action movies, but it's like saying to the world, I like being scared, but I don't like gore. I like,
right.
like Tim Burton type stuff. It's just like, I went to a trunk or treat a couple years ago, you know, which is what rural neighborhoods like, or people that don't have neighborhoods do. Like we don't really have a neighborhood, so we go to trunk or treats, and this family had a just Tim Burton everything was their display, and they had like two little kids with them, and they were like, that's like, we feel comfortable exposing our kids to this kind of scariness. It's not gonna give them nightmares, or if they do, it'll be kind of like a fun nightmare, you know, not a you know, keep them up all night.
Yeah.
So it is,
yeah, of course.
I think more than most of his movies, it's the one that has the farthest reach into our current pop culture. So, as always, Nick, this has been a lot of fun talking to you, and I hope this once again isn't the last time we do it. You are very active on TikTok and elsewhere in social media. How can people best watch your videos? Which, by the way, a lot of times I watch them because my sound is off on my phone and stuff, and so I don't get to hear it right away. I just start cracking up from the facial expressions of you and your fellow actors. But where can people follow you?
Sure, yeah. So my TikTok is basically my name. It's Nick Vincent Barbera. I've been thinking about changing it a couple times, but nah. I like it being myself. Because I have a lot on there. So yes, it's Nick Vincent Barbera on TikTok. And yes, I'm also on Instagram, Nick the Ghost Host 999. I'm sure you can guess what my favorite Disney ride is from that. And those are pretty much my main two that I am active on. So yeah, those are the main ones.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy them, and I love your characters that you make. There's one that you did this summer where you were like going through like a tunnel or something as the pirate character, and you guys were like, and you said something like, "Sorry about that, camera guy," or, you know, because it's all improvised, right? Like it's so much fun seeing you just like playing these characters that you invented. It's so cool.
Thank you. Let me actually, because you brought that up, let me talk about that for a split second, because that was a fun sure. one to do. So that is my friend Victor and I going through that tunnel. So there was this event at this place called Evermore Park in Utah, and it was called The Convergence, and it was basically a whole bunch of TikTokers that are into fantasy and D&D, and they were the ones who helped me grow on the app. And so I'm very thankful for them. So Victor's one of them. So that's both of our pirate characters going through like this creepy dungeon haunted castle kind of setup. And it was all improvised. He is an expert at improvisation. Like, he is so quick on his toes, and he is hilarious while he does it. So when we would just spend the day going through the park, finding different environments like that, and we would just say, oh, what if, and then we would just turn on the camera, and then we would just go through and just see what happens. So that's definitely one of my favorites too.
Well, it takes a certain talent to do it. You have that talent, so
thank you. Thank you so much.
Add that one more place that you can find Nick is if you go to Beetle House NYC. There he'll be, perhaps, most likely. And you'll see in his
I guess so, if I'm not on vacation, then yes, you will find me there.
Right. Well, I'd like to thank you once again for joining, and I'd like to thank you for listening, all of you at home or in the car, wherever you're listening to the EBS podcast, where everything, including The Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, is a primary source of time. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as Nick and I enjoyed making it. Please share, like, and leave a rating wherever you're listening to it now, and follow the show on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week when our topic is Back to the Future Part 2 with guest Dustin Redding. Until then, thanks for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.